55 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and it's always wonderful to have Nan here, and especially when she brings along some really interesting guests. And as a matter of fact, this time around, she's brought two guests with her, and we're together going to be exploring what will, I suspect, be a very unfamiliar term to most of you, or at least it was to me, a term called regenerative farming, which is proving to be a really important and emerging and rapidly growing practice, including right here in southeastern Wisconsin. So first of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm always happy to be here.
And tell us about the two guests that you have brought with you today.
This is exciting stuff for Kenosha County and the surrounding area as well, because as we know, all soil and water are connected. This is a new fresh look at farming practices. And we have two farmers with us, and farmer-to-farmer education and advocacy is probably the most effective way to improve how things are done. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about regenerative farming and what that means and how it's done, how does it impact soil health and water quality, and these two lovely people are so gracious to be here with us today.
Fantastic. So first of all, we have with us Kirsten Jersik, who is a resource conservationist and specifically a grazing specialist with Glacierland Resource Conservation and Development, a nonprofit based in Green Bay, although Kirsten, you were saying you work out of your home from the farm in Jefferson,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's correct. I have our Jefferson office.
Very good. And also with us is Paul Maggio, who is with Starry Nights Farm in Burlington and the leader of something brand new called the Kenosha Regenerative Producers Group, which is actually kind of making its big initial announcement today and in a sense on this morning show broadcast. This is one of the first instances of you really getting the word out about this brand new group, and we're really glad that you can be here. And before we went on the air, you were mentioning an interesting connection you have to Gateway Technical College.
Yeah, my mom was a she taught here for about 25 years. We lived down the road, and it was you know, pretty felt home. I feel at home here. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Well, we're glad to have both of you with us here on the morning show. So, Nan, did anything in particular prompt you to want to explore this notion of regenerative farming? Not that it's a surprise. It folds into a lot of the concerns that you bring up quite often on the morning show. But specifically regenerative farming, did anything in particular prompt this?
Well, first of all, I have to give a shout out to my girl, Laura Buska, my former colleague and current good friend. So she had met Kirsten and immediately emailed me and said, you need to have her on the radio because this is going to be a great show. This is what it's all about. And certainly we had the Racine County similar group on a few months ago talking about regenerative farming practices and how that impacts water quality specifically. And so now we have this another group in Kenosha County that is addressing these very same concerns. What's the impact of traditional grazing practices on soil and water quality? And Kirsten's going to talk about water quality and traditional farming in a little bit. And how do we improve both things? How do we produce food but also protect the watershed? And that's sort of a new way of thinking. Mm. It's kind of like the sun coming out after a cloudy day. So, yeah, it's very exciting and very important. And it also has to do with local food production and buying local and supporting local agricultural endeavors.
Fantastic. It's great to have both of you here. Let's get a little background information on both of you, first of all. So, Kirsten Jersik, first of all, tell us where you come from originally and a little bit about your own personal and professional life or lives, and how that's taken you ultimately to this current position you have with Glacier Land.
Sure. Yeah, well, I was raised on a small farm, a 125-acre farm in Jefferson County, the farm which I now farm, but I have expanded. And so when I grew up, I thought, boy, who'd ever work this hard for so little is, you know, kind of crazy. So I'm going to get a great job, go to college, and do some great things in life. And so I did, and I actually worked as a hydrogeologist for an environmental consulting firm for about 15 years. And I was kind of like seeing people point their finger at agriculture for water quality issues. Hmm. And I thought, that's not the agriculture I know, but I'd been away for a while. And so after we had a family and decided to change our lifestyle, we decided to move back to my family's farm. And I started farming. I had two little children. It was a beautiful way to raise a family. And I didn't want to drive tractor with a kid on each leg. That wasn't safe. And so we just started rotational grazing. We started learning more about it, and it was a system that fit our lifestyle very well. It fit our landscape very well, and I've never looked back.
Great. Tell us a little more about the farm specifically and what the farm was like growing up versus what it is now, or is it pretty much
actually raised by a conservationist. So my mother was a farmer, and she was very much, after reading Silent Spring by Rachel Carlson, she was never going to farm with chemicals. So we farmed naturally, but we still, we had cattle, but we still planted crops and harvested them and hauled them to our cattle and then deposited their waste on the field. So it's a lot more sustainable system to just go ahead and fence your whole farm and rotationally graze your animals across the farm instead of planting crops, harvesting crops, hauling them to your cattle, and then hauling the waste back out in the field. So in a way, I'm just a lot lazier, I think, and I let the cattle do the work.
Yeah, I heard guys say that, you know, we got it backwards, where the cows have legs, the grass have roots, but we actually, rather than moving the cows, we take something that can't move and bring it to the cows rather than having the cows move to the grass.
Interesting. So, yeah. So trying to reverse that practice. Right?
Yeah. And then a few years, I mean, after I've been was farming this way for about 10 years, maybe or a little less, I was asked to work as a for an RC&D as a grazing educator. And I was like, boy, I'm still learning this. So I started coordinating and hosting pasture walks, and I got to learn from like experts from across the country by having them be guest speakers at our events. And then I was working as a grazing educator, and then I also work for Glacierland RC&D as a grazing planner. So I go out to people's farms who want to convert to grazing and help them design their layout for their farm, and I help them seek cost share.
Fantastic. Yeah. We're going to learn a lot more about that, I hope, before we're done. Great. Paul Maggio, tell us a little bit about where you grew up. You've already talked about this little gateway connection, but
beyond that. I mean, I feel Kenosha is home to me. I grew up just down the street from the radio station here. I didn't grow up in farming. So after I went to St. Joe's High School locally here, and then a little bit at Parkside, and then I started working down in the markets in Chicago. So I started to really experience kind of our agricultural system through these commodity markets. And I had a nice career down there. We lived in Chicago, got married, had two kids down there, and always wanted to come back to, home for me. So we went through a crisis in 2008 with the financial crisis. I kind of saw the precipitous there from Chicago and seeing the markets and what happened, and then decided, it was going to be an investment in some farmland. Just I thought that might have been a safe thing. And my wife's like, okay, whatever. Well, I bought it the day after. She's like, I have no interest in conventional farming. If we're going to do this and have family and be with our kids here and stuff, I want it organically treated. And she was doing some nutrition studies at the time too and felt that was important. So we looked around. We couldn't find any organic farmers in Kenosha, none in Racine. So I'm saying, well, let's try this ourselves. So we got a mentor from East Troy to help us, and we started to convert the farm from a row crop farm into a grazing farm. And we were doing it from Chicago on the weekends and coming back and forth. Long story short, my career kind of came to a fork in the road in 2016. And my wife said to me, either we can continue on with what you were doing before, or we can do the farm, but it's not working for the family with doing both of them. So I just started getting more interested in farming, less in the financial markets, and we made that decision to say, okay, let's move back home. And we started to make that move in 2018. We moved fully back here. And then, we've been living at the farmstead now since 2020 and feel like, been doing it full time for 3 years now.
So, and where is the farm?
So the farm is in Wheatland, Wisconsin. So if you're not familiar, that's western Kenosha County, right next to Twin Lakes, just east of Lake Geneva, about 10, 15 miles. Mm.
And you were explaining when Nan asked you before you went on the air how you came up with the name Starry Nights. It's a lovely name. It's a lovely story behind that.
Yeah, and we would come up with our oldest daughter at the time, and she was, 6 years old, from the city of Chicago, where you see no stars there. And we would come to Kenosha, into the county, and she would look up and she would be like, oh, wow, look at those stars. And it just kind of made a resonance with us about the stars out here. So we called it Starry Nights, and no connection with Van Gogh. He actually, maybe took the idea from us, but yeah.
Very good. So Kirsten, explain the connection between you and Paul Maggio. How is it that you have come to know each other?
Yeah, I think we first met at a organic farming conference, the Midwest Organic Farming Conference, years ago, and just started talking, and Paul told me where their farm was and what they were doing, and I'm always looking for people to host field days and pasture walks to educate other farmers about what they're doing, and Paul and Marissa were willing to do so. So we hosted a pasture walk at their farm, and we've just been working together ever since. So I help people work through NRCS cost share programs.
So the NRCS is a National Resource Conservation Service. It's part of the USDA.
Their goal is to better our environment, and they very much understand that rotational grazing is one of the best practices we can use to better our environment. And so they provide cost share to install fencing, put in water lines and farms, and we were realizing at Paul's farm he might have needed a little bit more infrastructure to make his job of rotating the cattle a little bit easier. So I started working with Paul and Marissa on that, and then they're just great. Their farm is amazing, like seeing just over the years how their farm has changed and how much thicker their grasses are and how many more pollinators are there and grassland birds. It's like been a really cool cycle to see it progress and change, and to see it be located right next to restored prairie, and to see similar things going on in their regenerative pastures and in the native prairie has been pretty cool to see.
Wow.
So I've known them through, we host events there every year. We work together on that. And then about a year and a half ago, maybe we started saying, hey, there's these producer-led watershed groups around the state. There's not one in Kenosha County, and Paul became very interested in establishing that. So worked with him and other farmers in the county to help get that established.
Fantastic. So let's talk about, first of all, kind of the problem that gets us here that makes it important to embrace this practice called regenerative farming. From what I have read, this is rooted, at least to some extent, in some of the ravages of climate change. So what is it, what's going on in climate change that has prompted kind of the wider embrace of this thing called regenerative farming?
Well, so I think when we talk about climate change, obviously we have terrible carbon release problems, right? And so when we look at the carbon release maps of the Midwest, we can see that row crops without cover crops cause a problem. So before that corn gets, you know, 18 inches tall and starts to canopy, or 22 inches tall and starts to canopy over the rows it was planted in, and the soybeans too, we have severe carbon releases. And the carbon release maps in, you know, from April till middle of June are just really, really red. And so that's very problematic.
Can you explain more what's going on? I mean,
so carbon is without the soil being covered. So without the soil being covered by a plant or a mulch or something, carbon is released from the soil into the atmosphere.
So it's not through the plants, it's from the soil being released into the air.
And what happens with plants is they sequester carbon back down into the soil. So when we think about regenerative agriculture, we look at soil health principles. And we have five soil health principles. The first is to no-till or use minimal tillage. So I think the plow a long time ago was like the real start of this problem, right? We come in and we plow up the land and we're releasing carbon, but we're also like destroying the home of all these little soil microbes that live in the soil and really are our employees on our farms for us. And then we need to keep the ground covered. And we want to keep the ground covered, you know, 365 days a year, so that we're not releasing carbon and so that we're feeding the soil microbiology that lives in the soil. And then we want to have diverse species. So if you think about the native plants that were here before we were and before our plow destroyed them, you know, we had a lot of different diversity of like grasses and legumes and forbs. And these things have really different, really vast root systems that really feed the soil biology. And also they're very tall and they sequester a lot of carbon and they put it very deep in the ground because the roots are so deep.
Yeah, and besides that aspect of it as a grazer, all this diversity of plants there, it's almost apothecary for our animals. Mm. So what they can do is they can graze on certain things that they may need at that time, that these plants have different roots that are bringing up different minerals up that they can digest. And so the more diversity, like human beings, if we only ate one thing, that's not super healthy for us. But as herbivores, that they can select a bunch of different grasses, forbs, people call them weeds, whatever it is, it's a good, healthy thing for the animal out there.
Yeah, and we're just working with nature. So instead of, you know, battling nature, so like that wasn't a great idea when we came in and put concrete in our rivers, right? Like, very problematic. And so regenerative agriculture is really just working with nature more and more. And so whether we're doing rotational grazing, or if we're going to, when we're doing row crop farming, if we can use cover crops so that we plant a cover crop when we harvest our crop, and so that over the winter that crop is covering the ground and we don't have that barren ground, and then we can plant green. I mean, there's a saying I love, planting green keeps the water clean. So if we can keep the ground covered at all times, we really reduce runoff. But not only do we reduce runoff, we're bettering our soils so that the water that infiltrates is a cleaner water.
Yeah. So I guess to what Kirsten's saying, with at our farm, everything's in perennial. So we don't retill and replant and things. So there's always that cover. There's always living roots in the soil. There's so those regenerator principles really happen with grazing. I mean, it really goes up the whole ladder there. But if you're going to row crop, we're trying to mimic those perennial plants by having plant there all the time. So if you plant an annual like corn, if you can get something in before or after there, it's going to mimic a perennial plant that nature does with having it always a living plant in there. So you can do it. It's more effort, but there's benefits from that too. So we're trying to mimic, again, nature with perennial by doing annuals sequentially there.
Very good. I want to make sure I understand the list of five. So no-till, perpetual ground kill.
No disturbance. So that can be tilling. It can be chemicals. It can be, anytime you disturb the soil, that's what we're trying to avoid.
Okay. So no-till means more than just don't plow. Don't interfere with the soil.
Yeah. Find ways to keep those critters alive and not destroy them.
Right. Ground cover, you were saying, diverse species. Then what comes after that to finish out the list of five?
Having a living plant in the soil at all time. And then last, which I think is the highest point, is having grazing animals on the land where they can incorporate this much faster about recycling nutrients in there. Those animals help do that to our environment better than anything.
It's just what used to happen here. So, before we came here, before white men came, we had, bison grazing across. We had oak savannas. We had tall grasses. And we had the bison coming through and grazing across the land. So they would eat their food and recycle the nutrients and move on and graze somewhere else. And so, again, we're mimicking that with our grazing.
Yeah. And that's how the great farmland in the area was created, was through those animals coming, eating, depositing that carbon, getting sequestered in there and building soil that way. So that's what we're trying to do.
Interesting. Without any scientists coming along, it was just our humankind's own wisdom in the moment. I mean, I suppose the connection with the earth helped them understand, and it just worked.
Mm-hmm.
It just worked.
It's interesting that this philosophy and many of these principles can be applied to homeowners. You don't have to be a farmer to do this. Everybody needs healthy soil. And currently what we do with our soil in suburbs especially is that we have this crop called grass, and then we do all of these things to the grass, but we don't. It doesn't do anything at all for soil health. The roots are really short, and we tend to hire lawn services that pour all kinds of chemicals onto it so that the grass stays greener longer and gets greener sooner, and you don't have any things living in the soil anymore. So those kinds of practices need to be improved because we can't just have healthy soil on farmlands. These little islands of healthy soil, if you will, we have to have healthy soil everywhere because it's all connected. It's all connected with stormwater runoff. It's all connected with water quality. And so those kinds of principles are especially important in cities and suburbs as well.
Interesting.
Obviously, you can't have a bison grazing in your front yard. That's true. but there are other things that can be done. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think kind of what Kirsten got me interested in this was, first of all, Kenosha County didn't have a producer water-led group. And again, this is started by the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. And they really, and I think it was genius by them, but they have producers leading it. Rather than, government telling us what to do, we're left up to our own to figure this out, And I think that I would rather be in that situation than all of a sudden the water quality continues to deteriorate and then someone forcing me to make changes. So I think, as farmers, hopefully we're thinking about that and how we can do that. But one of the things is when you get past I-94 to the west, I think MB is the cutoff, the highway MB, but everyone is on well water out there. Here at Kenosha City, you have municipal water, but out there is well water. So it's really our collective water source out there that we all are tapping our wells into and we're drinking, and it's an important resource for that whole area. So when you think about Kenosha County and the farmers, if you look at all the land in Kenosha County, 43% of that is controlled by farmers. I mean, that's a massive amount of land. And then if you look at the population of farmers in Kenosha, it's less than 1% of the population. So we're a small percent, but we have a tremendous amount of power. I mean, we interact with water more than any other industry in the whole county of Kenosha. So in a sense, you know, this is the best analogy I can think of, but, you know, we can be superheroes here about water cleaning in our county. You know, if we can just change a few little practices and make that happen. And I mean, it's an important service for the whole community and protecting that resource that we all share out there.
So it's a modest number of people who can have an enormous impact upon the whole county.
Yeah.
That's an important point.
But I think a bigger point to that is that's a lot of responsibility for less than 1% to do all this protection. And it's also a lot of financial risk and responsibility for these farmers. Hmm. And farming isn't a lucrative income. I mean, it's very difficult work, and it doesn't pay real well, to be quite frank. It's a beautiful lifestyle. But I think consumers can take their part in it by buying local products. So the American farmer has always raised what the consumer has wanted. And as long as the consumer wants cheap processed food, we'll continue to do corn and bean row crops. And, you know, the farmers not make a lot off that and degrade our environment. But when the consumer changes what they want and decides they would like to buy nutritious local food from raised locally here in the county from farms, that's where it'll be easier for more farmers to change their practices as well.
Yeah. And I guess too, that aspect of it, if you look at it, these numbers came out from the USDA, but there's probably less than 3% of all the agricultural goods that are made in Kenosha County, less than 3% is actually sold locally here. So that means 97% is brought in from another place to feed the population here.
I just want to emphasize what Kirsten just said. Consumers have the power. Everyone listening to this broadcast has the power to change that sort of appalling figure that Paul just mentioned. There are so many resources within Kenosha County to source locally grown food, whether it's produce or meat or eggs or whatever it may be. You just have to know where the resources are and how to access those.
Yeah, and it's a little, I'll guarantee you, it's less convenient than going to a grocery store, but it's better. You know your farmer. That money, it'll make a difference to the farmer. I mean, he can increase his income from that, do better things with that. So with your dollars, you're really helping improve the environment if you can support those, that aspect of it.
We talk about the environment and water quality, but really it's like a whole holistic system once we're farming better this way. So, you know, we're improving the soil health. We're providing better nutrition for our plants and animals that are living in there. So therefore, those plants and animals are providing better nutrition for us.
Yeah, if you are what you eat, that's how it works. I mean, if your animal's getting a healthy diet of things, then that's going to reflect, you know, into you as you consume that.
And then we're also providing like amazing pollinator habitat. So, you know, some people think, you know, we can plant pollinator habitat in our backyards, which is fantastic. But on our regenerative farms, it's also just in our fields. So we frequently have different plants. Like when in our pastures, our milkweed just grows. Like we don't plant it grows. And the cattle, they don't eat it. They eat around it. It's actually toxic to them. But it's beautiful to see all these monarch butterflies and native bees and native beetles out in our pastures. And then as all that returns, grassland birds are really in trouble. And I think they're really delightful to our eyes and ears. And people don't even know, a lot of people don't even know what noisy grassland birds sound like. Sometimes they're almost annoying. They're so noisy at our house. But I love that.
No, I love going out there and just walking the pastures to move the cattle and hearing the birds there. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm a birder, but, you know, bobolinks, you know, they're all over the place. Before, I just see them returning to our land. Red-winged blackbirds, meadowlarks, all those type of birds are coming because there's a habitat again for them that got maybe destroyed through you know,
the
through the plow. Yeah.
But they all lived, you know, together. Like our animals rotate, and I double check, and you know, those nests are still there with eggs in them, and we graze certain ways during different times of year to protect and restore that. But you know, then the birds are there to keep the insect population in check. So it's just this big
and they provide a
system.
Fertility. I mean, if you think about like boron, this is a micronutrient. You know, the birds bring that into our farm. So those are things that. You know, how these things, sometimes I don't even comprehend, like, how nature has already set up all this stuff, and we as human beings are learning about it, but it's pretty amazing what it's actually done if you let it work its work, you know.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking about regenerative farming with Kirsten Jersick, who is a resource conservationist with Glacier Land Resource Conservation and Development, and we're talking with Paul Maggio, who is a local farmer, Starry Nights Farm in Burlington, and also leader of the brand new Kenosha Regenerative Producers Group. Kirsten, I want to be sure to take a couple minutes to have you kind of talk in more detail about what you do as a grazing specialist, and that when a farmer is interested in shifting their practices towards regenerative farming, one of the things that can happen is for you to come in and give them help in terms of how best to do that. So create a scenario in which Farmer X has called for your assistance and for your advice on this. What would that sort of look like typically?
Sure. So I've been working with several beginning farmers in Kenosha County who called me last year and said, hey, we're interested in doing rotational grazing on our farm, could you come help us? So I go out, I meet the farmer, I pull some background data, I look at what kind of soils they have there, I look at where water bodies are, I look at the depth to groundwater, I look at all these, you know, background data so that we're being environmentally safe to have livestock come onto this land. And then I work through the farmer with what are their overall goals, you know, how many acres do they have, how many do they, you know, their overall goals for their farm. And then we lay their farm out. So where would we put our fencing? So how would we fence the farm? In great systems, we have water lines in every field. So where would our water lines go? What are we going to do with the animals in the winter? You know, what type of animal are you going to have? How much forage will your land produce? So I work through all these scenarios with the farmer to come up with a system that will work best for their farm. Hmm. And their human resource, you know, how much labor do they have?
Yeah, the context of what they want to do is what Kirsten helps them work through, too.
Yep. And then, you know, do they have equipment? Are there neighbors that have equipment who can help them? So I sit down, and it takes about 6 months to work with somebody pretty closely, and I get to know them pretty well, hopefully. And then we come up with a plan that I recommend, but that they're very much have their buy-in. Like, their decisions are totally what the plan is.
Right.
Just make their goals work for them.
And clarify the term rotational grazing. I mean, what is the rotation that is occurring? What are we rotating between or around?
Yeah, so we're rotating our animals across our landscape. So we move them every day to a fresh pasture.
And we're mimicking the bison here is what Kirsten.
Moving through. So we have like, we might have a, you know, a 100-acre farm fence. So we have big perimeter fence around the outside. And then we have less intense fences on the inside. And then daily, we have this little poly wire, we call it, that's just a little temporary fence that we put up, and it keeps our animals in, you know, 1 acre. And then the next day...
And that's done by electricity. So we have an electric fence, and this poly wire has metal filaments in it. And if you clip on from an electric fence source, you can create another internal electric fence from there to keep them in that space that you want them to stay that day. And they'll respect it once they get trained to that electric fence.
And then the next day they move on to their next acre. And the size of that area we give them depends on how many animals we have, of course, and then how much moisture we have, so how much forage we have there. So this year our paddocks are a lot bigger than they might have been last year with this drought. So they move along in a systematic way, very much evenly eating their own food and depositing their own waste.
So I guess I would say another analogy here is if you, what's called grazing continuous grazing, which it happens at a lot of farms, it's not necessarily a good practice, but that would be akin to saying, okay, I'm going to leave the house for a couple days to your 12-year-old kid, you've got food left out. Here's your broccoli. Here's this. Here's your chicken. There's ice cream over here and this. And say, just help yourself. Ice cream's going to go first and continue to find that. So the cattle, if you let them continuously graze, they'll be eating the ice cream rather than the other stuff. So if you have a smaller paddock and you let them, they'll more evenly graze. And then that one plant won't just continually get picked and eventually die. And then you'll just have species there that are unpalatable because they didn't eat them, but they're going to get a super competitive advantage because they're not getting picked on, and that's what will grow there.
Interesting. Yeah. So you're guiding the cattle and making sure that they're getting, in a sense, a diverse diet, plus what they're doing benefits the farm in a more even fashion.
Yeah, and so, you know, they eat some food, and then they move on, and then that plant rests and regrows. And then in 30 to 45 days, we come back on the same piece of land with the animals. So in essence, they sort of leapfrog across the farm from paddock to paddock. Mm. And
then that rest period is what's really important, because those grasses then come back and express themselves again. They grow stronger. They get deeper root systems, because basically the grasses are like a mirror. So what you see above, that's the root system below. And when you eat half of that grass, that root system dies back half. All that carbon's deposited into the soil. And that's how we capture carbon, really, through this practice, is that root system keeps pumping carbon into that soil, which is an amazing thing, as long as we're giving it rest and moving those animals frequently.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
How do you get water out to them in the different paddocks every time?
Yeah, so we just have water lines, so we can either lay them on the surface of the ground. They're seasonal. So just PVC pipe, water line, and with...
It's connected to the well, and then it pushes the water out there, and then you have these tanks that, you know, it's not high technology, but it's technology out there to move water in each pasture and have it available there through some of these grazing resources that we use.
Have a hose that connects to the water line, and then just a small water tank. And
it's got a float like your toilet that gets to a certain point, it stops off, and, you know, they drink it down, and the water keeps flowing.
Mm-hmm. And then they have fresh, you know, nice cold water in every paddock. So they can either be laid on the surface, they can be buried shallow. And in the winter, when we're wintering animals out on pastures, we do deep buried water line, you know, just like you have in the city here, to go out. And we have drinkers off of those.
So you don't require children to schlep buckets out
there? No children. I don't carry water on my head anymore. No.
Those were the days.
Yeah, those are things, though, that in the plan. So there's the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. Here in southeast Wisconsin, I usually work with Rhea out of the Union Grove office. And so we help farmers get cost share to install their fences and their water lines and to seed their pastures or to plant cover crops. So we help. The plan we write helps qualify the farmer for cost share for these programs. And so then we work closely with government agencies to help the farmers. And so we all work together super close, and it's really fun.
When we had Brian Gunderson on a couple of months ago, sort of the Racine counterpart of your Kenosha group, he was talking about costs. And you know, yes, it costs a little bit more to do cover cropping and that sort of thing, perhaps a little more effort on the part of the farmer. But when you think about what the long-term costs would be, and we're experiencing that now, if you don't do that, you know, you can't think about the short-term gain necessarily. You have to think about the long-term cost, and the long-term benefit, of course, is carbon sequestration.
Clean water and healthy soil and all of those things.
You know, soil to erosion, too, if you don't have stuff in the winter. I mean, I saw it on fields this year where we didn't have a snow cover, the wind blew, and you could see it piling up in the ditch there. And if you're even a landowner, I mean, if you would have to truck in that ground from some other place, that's, I don't know, $300-$400 a truckload. In a sense, you know, you might be getting rent on that, but you're going to be losing soil that, you know, if you're an apartment owner, that part of it, your apartment leaves every year to something else that you're not really taking into account. So,
I want to circle back for a second to this matter of no-till, and I'm specifically interested in, although I was glad Paul clarified that no-till really means even more than don't plow the soil. It also means don't interfere with the soil. But more specifically, the literal no-till part of it. So why was soil plowed? Why did we ever plow soil? What was the point? Well, and what do we have to do differently in order to not plow?
I mean, I think from when you're planting annual plants, something that's going out there during a certain time of year, corn, soybeans, whatever it is, you don't want any competition for that plant. So you're going to destroy everything that's there. And so that plant gets all the water, all the nutrients, all the sunlight, really everything that it requires. And if you have no competition for it, that plant's going to be able to express itself. And that's really the idea with it. And then, you know, so there's no diversity. It's that, and that's what it gets.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, in order to grow a row crop, like, you couldn't have planted your row crop into the tall prairie that was here, right? So you had to terminate that tall prairie. And when the plow came along, there wasn't chemicals to terminate, hence the plow. And so that's, I think, you know, that's where it came from.
So it's an instrument of death. The plow.
Plow is really an instrument of death.
So I think there's unintended consequences. I don't think people thought about that, like, you know, this is creating damage. It's like, okay, I can grow this plant that I really want, you know. And so I just think that as we learn more and more about things, I mean, look at stuff that our parents did, and they're like, well, asbestos or Agent Orange or whatever, you know, DDT, whatever, that was something that was used. And then we learned through time that that's not such a good thing, you know. So I think these are unintended consequences that as time goes on, we learn the effects of them. So nothing intentional by people, but it worked. But, you know, there's
better
the other side to it, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if there is no plow, then what does a farmer do instead? I mean, what replaces that old practice?
So I think it's, you know, we've been using no-till on our farm here. And what we do, it's a system where it does make a small incision into the soil and deposits the seed, then covers it up. So it's just a lot less disturbance there. But then again, there's other education and other things you've got to do to get better as a farmer with other practices to try and find, okay, how do I sequence this? What plants can go in here? What plants are going to decompose over the winter so I don't have to deal with having to plow something to, you know, not have as much competition there? How do I control weeds, you know, through suppression with other plants and other type of rotation? So these are things that are out there, people are doing, and people are successful. And hopefully, you know, with our group and with funding, that we can get experts to come in and help us do that. I don't consider myself an expert in row cropping, or I get the concepts and ideas, but I think there's people out there that are successful that can come and help us get to those points.
Nan used a term earlier that intrigued me, which was farmer to farmer. That it makes so much sense for, in a sense, farmers to be the evangelists here, in terms of. But by and large, for St. Kirsten at Glacier Land Resource Conservation Development, do you have farmers coming to you that, in a sense, have already converted?
Oh, yeah. So we work with a lot of people who've been doing this for, you know, 20, 30 years, or are retiring and looking for new people to replace them on their farm. So we have a lot of mentorship with people that are exiting, or, you know, have been doing this for 20 years. So when we go to a new neighborhood, if someone calls us, frequently we're referred by another farmer. They say, hey, my neighbor wants to start doing this. Can we go talk to him? So there's a lot of farmer-to-farmer mentoring that happens in our groups. And our grazing networks, we call them, they've been around for over 20, you know, 30 years. And the producer-led watershed groups are kind of the same thing, just different groups of farmers getting together for different reasons. So we've always had a lot of mentorship with our grazing networks and education. And
I suppose that's also one means by which it's not just the converted helping each other, but in a sense doing that conversion, spreading the word so more and more farmers know about these new practices and can come to an understanding and appreciation of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people follow each other on social media now, right? We didn't have that when we were younger, but a lot of beginning farmers I work with, you know, follow Paul and Marissa at Starry Nights on their social media, and they're like, I meet them because Paul and Marissa are generous enough to host a pasture walk at their farm. And then people are like, I've been following this farm. I've been wanting to see this farm. How do I get started doing this? And then, you know, if they're Paul's neighbor, he's going to go over and check on them through the process, too, and work with them. Or if they're in my neighborhood, you know, other people are. So we all really network together. And I think, like, we work really well collaboratively together for the same cause of healthy soil and clean water. And
it's a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
Nan made the point that, as you have, that that one piece of this for just regular folks is to be supportive of local farmers. And so what would be the specific means in which, you know, for instance, Paul, somebody listening who wants to be supportive of your efforts, support you and other local farmers, how exactly can they do that? I mean, do they have to show up at your farm? Are there other means by which they can purchase what you are creating?
For our purposes, you know, for Starry Nights Farm, we do have a website where we have an online store that people can buy beef from us, pork, chicken. You know, there's other farmers that do it. If you do a Google search, you can find other farmers, you know, that have advertised. Some, you know, don't have that. They don't want to market, or they don't want to be in contact with the public. But I think through this Kenosha Producers Group, I would like to try and get some things established where we can have a better connection to, let's say, the two farmers markets that we have here in Kenosha downtown, you know, the Harbor Market and the other Kenosha market that's there, the public market. So if we can connect with them, maybe restaurants that are wanna, rather than just buying frozen fruit and going to the fryer, you know, they can have more of a fresh food that they're offering. And if they can find that connection to us, maybe through this Kenosha Producers Group, where they can source local foods for the restaurants, for individuals that want to do that. So if we can just find ways to build up our local network here, not only does it help connect, you know, urban and rural and bridge that divide between the two, but it's going to support the farmers. It's going to have a healthier product for the consumer. It's just going to make Kenosha a much more resilient place as far as our food system goes.
Fantastic.
And I think a thing a producer could do. So the Kenosha County Regenerative Producers webpage launched yesterday, last night maybe, or this morning, and it's KenoshaProducers.org. But I think they could go on there and they could leave us a message that they'd be interested to help, because like when you ask us some of these questions, like think about the heavy load on our shoulders. So here we're 1% of the population. We're controlling 43% responsible for doing proper farming practices that are relatively new on 43% of our landscape. And now we're also supposed to raise all this healthy food. And now we're supposed to create a super easy way to distribute it to the consumer.
Right.
So we need the consumers to help us because we're like super busy farming.
Sure.
You know?
Very good point. I'm glad you said that. That's important to remember. If people want to get more information about Glacier Land, how do they do that?
Yes. Yeah, so they can email me at Kirsten@GlacierlandRCD.org, or they can just Google Glacierland RCD. You'll come to our webpage and a message will get to me.
And it's a beautiful website. Mm-hmm. It really is. So there's a lot of amazing information there. This has been terrific. You have really helped us understand some exciting new possibilities for healthier, more sustainable farm practices.
Thank you. And we also would love to welcome anybody who'd like to join the next producer-led watershed group meeting for the Kenosha County group.
Next week?
Yeah, it's next week, July 18th at 5 p.m. at Joe Wiltiger's farm. And that address is 8403 368th Avenue in Burlington.
That's in Wheatland also. And again, this is for farmers and landowners that have an interest in, you know, getting involved with regenerative agriculture.
Fantastic. And all are welcome.
Is that on the Kenosha Producers website?
It will be.
And that website again was what?
Is KenoshaProducers.org.
Good. Very excellent.
Good. Yeah, we'll get that up there so that these people can get that address.
Great. Kirsten Jersik and Paul Maggio, it's been great to meet both of you, and I hope this isn't your last visit to the morning show. You had a lot of exciting things to share.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much. Okay. Nan, I know you have a couple of announcements.
Yes. Very exciting stuff going on this weekend. Hawthorne Hollow is officially opening 25 acres of newly restored land to the public with over 2 miles of new trails, a boardwalk over the new wetland. This will be on Saturday, July 15th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., commencing with a symbolic and very meaningful ribbon-cutting ceremony. If you have any questions, you can certainly call Hawthorne Hollow or you can go to the website and they can help you out with that. Riverbend Nature Center is having a moonlight paddle. Doesn't that sound lovely? A moonlight paddle on August 4th. They launch at 6:30 to 7 p.m. and then there will be music from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. If you don't want to paddle, you don't have to. You can just come and enjoy the campfire and uh, a,